fool enough or crazy enough. As well. I don't know.
Our next talk by Sebastian Rai is on highly oscillatory PDEs, slow manifolds, and regularized PDE formations.
All right, thank you, Ari. So, so we're going to slow down in many ways from the last three talks. So first of all, we're going to go down to a slow manifold, so we're going to actually ignore the oscillations for a while. And then secondly, I'll try, be brave enough and actually give a blackboard talk, which is a bit of an experiment. Certainly not quite as experienced as Robert McKay, and my handwriting is pretty bad. So please stop me if things get out of hand. The other thing is, I actually was quite a bit motivated by the talk that Robert gave yesterday. So my first, in the first part of my talk, I will actually make quite a bit of references to this, and then that actually naturally leads into my talk. So I think it's actually useful to, because obviously the word slow manifold appears in both talks, to make this link. And unfortunately, Robert is not here anymore, so maybe it's good, actually. Okay, so we'll start in the first talk. I will sort of... I'll try to say something about slow manifolds. Now, if you actually to talk about slow and fast, in particular in the context of PDEs, it only makes sense if you actually say with respect to what time scale, right? So slow and fast and then you should really be talking about a slow manifold with respect to this time scale tau. So the system I have in mind is a Hamiltonian system. So for the first part, I will simply make it finite dimensional. Eventually, we'll move on to sort of wave equations, etc. So there's now no parameter here. So we just this is a Hamiltonian system with oscillations in there, and depending on this tau, if tau is very small, then probably everything will be actually slow. Yes, everything will be slow. Now, if tau, you increase tau, part of the solution will be considerably fast, etc., etc. And then you want to basically naturally adjust what the slow manifold is to this situation, right? So being an numeric analysis person, you want to work with a numerical motivated definition for that. And so we're actually going to take tau equal to step size of a numeric method. Do I have to repeat the whole first part of my talk now? No. Okay, hopefully not. All right, so, and what is naturally is the following, and I think that's probably not entirely new. It has been used probably in the context of stiff ODEs being stiff in the sense of dissipative. So you use an implicit homocoupling method, and that gives us one estimate of the solution. So I call this implicit method, starting from a point Z, and then we compare this to an explicit method, which I call Z1. Apply to the same point, and then we would call
our slow manifold depends on a parameter epsilon and this delta t, and it's a set of all points for which sort of your local error estimator is smaller than a tolerance epsilon. Okay. We'll see where that gets us eventually. So now let's walk this through for a very simple example. And we're going to do the same that Robert McKay had yesterday, the stiff spring. Stiff spring pendulum, or you could equally well do this for the spaceship we just saw in David's talk, where you had this vibrating coupled, space station, really. And actually, this is an example where you really want to be on a slow manifold. I don't think I wanted to be in that spaceship as he showed it, right? This highly oscillatory vibrating thing. So you definitely want to avoid these oscillations when you're on a spaceship, I would think. So in this case, we are, let's say, even in R2, we introduce a function g of q. This is going to be the length, the sort of the stiff spring. Then there's, I need for further reference, capital G going to be the Jacobian of small g. There's a stiffness constant. And what else do we need? The equations of motion. So we assume some force, not necessarily conservative, but let's, for the moment, say that's generated by a potential, but it's not essential. Right, and so let's go back to McKay's talk and what he proposed. Or some of it is actually sort of, I guess, familiar in this context. So he talked about this initial manifold, your first guess. Well, the first guess, of course, is just the points where you say you replace this by a rigid rod, right? So, and you get a corresponding constraint on the velocities. And that's your first guess. And then he talked about the case where you radially outwards project and you sort of, in a way, what you do is minimizing the energy in that direction. So that was his improved manifold. And that is with the J tilde, quite naturally, the way I've done it, given by. So what if you project? I mean, this is basically a gradient of the energy. What's written here, right? The potential energy. This is the whole expression here. If you write down the potential energy for this system, then this is a gradient in. And so if you just want to look at the gradient into this radial directions, then this is nothing else than multiplying this whole expression here by g. That's the gradient in the direction of the constraint. And so that's it. And this has now the nice features Robert McKay was talking about, that all the equilibria are, of course, naturally part of this manifold. Trivial, right? Because then this is zero anyway. All the equilibria are part of this on this manifold. Okay, so, but that's not quite the end of the story. Then Robert was also talking about this periodic motion on this manifold. Now, what is this? This is basically when you start taking the stiff spring and swinging it around. So what will happen? It will stretch due to the centripetal forces, right? So it will be sort of a relative equilibrium you obtain. So there's an additional term that's actually velocity dependent. And so you get an even improved sort of slow manifold by saying you have to, well, you basically take the way I'm going to define it. Well, it's just g tilde plus and h is the Hessian. All right, so this is the correcting term that comes from the centripetal forces. And that sort of would correspond to one of the cases that Robert McKay talked about yesterday when you have internal motion on the slow manifold. It comes basically from the curvature, because what this is actually, this is nothing what's written here. It's the second time derivative of small g. So the improved second slow manifold is nothing else than defined by the second derivative of g, the time derivative of g. Okay, so now let's apply our definition of a slow manifold. And so we're gonna pick the most simple pair. This is gonna be the implicit midpoint. And for the explicit method, I use forward Euler. In fact, we make it even simpler now if we do the calculation. The implicit midpoint is half a step of the implicit Euler, half a step explicit Euler. So actually, I'm just going to look at the half steps. And you're going to write down everything. In the half step variables, so and I just I suppress the arguments. Here I will use the overbar in half is the approximation of g at the midpoint using the implicit approximation. And then, so this is one approximation. The other one is quite trivial for, and all we need is actually from the explicit Euler, and that's that's the approximation to g using the explicit Euler method. So now we essentially all that matters, we assume that the step size is small enough so that you, or that this is force is soft enough that that's, you could actually make this an explicit approximation here as well. It wouldn't change anything. So the real troublesome term is this. So you do a bit. So what we only really need to control in terms of our definition is actually not the complete solution vector, but it's actually good enough to say the stiff part is this here, and you want to control this, essentially. So this then is the definition of the slow manifold. Now, I also drop at this stage all the indices because everything's going to be at the midpoints. And I do a bit of Taylor expansion. And so you end up with the following system. All the involved quantities are evaluated at the midpoints. Now, if you discuss this, then you see that essentially, if delta t times k is small, so you use a small time step compared to the fast oscillations, there's basically then no constraint on these on this difference. I mean, imposed by this, because this is gonna be small anyway, right? So if this is small, so the slow manifold essentially disappears, right? Or it's all of space. That's quite natural. And so the more interesting bit is delta k much larger than one, and then you essentially get that you control. If you go through all this, you get that you basically your numerical method define sees itself as a slow manifold in an epsilon neighborhood of the slow manifold we introduced here in M1. So the interesting bit is that basically if you integrate with, one of the conclusions is that if you use the implicit midpoint method to solve the stiff spring pendulum and you start out on G tilde, then at least over one step you will stay close to G tilde, and of course it's a more bold step to say you will stay close to this manifold. But it's sort of the implicit midpoint method naturally sees this as a slow manifold. Now, the problematic bit is that it doesn't see this. So if you were to solve the fast spinning problem, where you sort of swing around the stiff spring, the implicit midpoint would sort of try, it doesn't see the relative equilibria. It basically ignores this. So implicit midpoint doesn't see and in fact it can go unstable. I mean it's and that was observed by Carlo Simo and sort of in the mid-90s, early 90s, he actually used this argument to advocate this energy momentum methods. Now there's a fix to it. And the fix is essentially that in this approximation here, you don't use the midpoint value, but in here you use the trapezoidal approximation. Just in there. And then you go through the analysis again and you make use of the fact that that this is equal to our old G plus this term that you've been missing. So it's just a slight difference between trapezoidal approximation and an implicit midpoint approximation if you use large time steps. Okay, so far so good. I mean, so we basically can say that if you use a you apply implicit midpoint or this modified variant to the stiff spring pendulum or some bit more complex systems, you sort of stay on the slow manifold, and that's okay. But it's still an implicit method, so of course a huge success method in solving stiff ODEs or PDEs are really linearly implicit methods. Now, if you look at Hamiltonian systems, it's actually not clear at all, or it's not so trivial, to get good linearly implicit methods. And that's because the common linearly implicit methods are basically not reversible in time. So it's not so easy to get a symmetric linearly implicit method. But it's actually now quite easy, once you've gone through this this analysis, to get a linearly implicit method that's time reversible and symmetric. Because what you do is you combine this equation up there, this here, with the leapfrog method. So So you take essentially the equations as they are. You stack the variables. And in leapfrog, you would evaluate G, the stiff term, at the level n. That, of course, causes instabilities. So we're just going to replace this by the corrected G, so to speak. And then the rest is basically this equation up there. So it's this and and this is, I think it's just our G tilde at n. Right? I mean, this is the this improved sort of constraint function. And that's, you all that you have to invert is this matrix. So in this case, it's just a scalar equation, but it can be sort of, it becomes a matrix. You can actually show that on a linear, I mean, if everything is linear here and constant coefficient, it's actually, you can show complete equivalence with the implicit midpoint method. So the linear stability is as for the implicit midpoint method. But it now also works for the nonlinear case. And so I think especially for elastomechanics, that's quite a promising method. Work with Tobias. There's actually one, only one sort of catch to this, which is a bit annoying at this stage, that in general we can't show that this is a Hamiltonian system. So it's time reversible, it has angular linear momentum conservation, so all this is okay, but we have been unable to really show that this is Hamiltonian. Energy is very well conserved for all practical simulations, but we don't have, we haven't found any sort of rigorous structure for this yet. Right. Now, this is basically not the way the whole work started. It came really out of applications to meteorology and joint work with UK Met Office, in particular Stanley Forth and Wood, Nigel Wood. And basically, the reason was exactly that they basically use a linearly implicit time-stepping method because they want to solve the full Euler equations, but the step size is typically so, I mean, in all cases, if you solve a PDE, that you have unresolved fast motions. And so to get stability, they use a linearly implicit method. They don't want to go to a fully implicit method because it's way too expensive. But because it's not clear, or so far it wasn't clear, how to get a symmetric in time, linearly implicit method, they basically had instabilities, which then were controlled by damping, off-centering. And once you off-center, they found that the variability gets too small, so what you do, you add noise. Right? So the whole system gets shaken up again, and that's typically called a subgrid model. Right? So... But in fact, it's now extending this idea, or actually this is where the original idea came originally from. You want to use this So the popular toy problems are the shallow water equations. They are in a rotating frame, so that's why the Carolus term is there. F is constant for the time being. G is gravitational constant. H is the layer depth, so think of a fluid layer, atmosphere as a single fluid layer. Motion is entirely horizontal. I guess those of you who have heard talking to me about this have probably seen these equations now often enough. And so the basic idea is... and we're now also applying this to the full 3D equations, is you replace this equation by a regularized fluid equation. And the regularization consists in nothing else than basically saying there's a bar and you get a Helmholtz problem to solve. And the right-hand side is sort of slow manifold, yet you maintain numerically, and that again you get out of the analysis of the implicit midpoint method applied as a rotor method. I mean, you don't discretize in space; you formally just discretize in time. You control the time derivative of the divergence, so you keep this essentially small. It's not the divergence itself. So this would be the wrong thing to enforce, because the flow is actually compressible, slowly compressible. So what you can then do is a semi-Lagrangian leapfrog. Of the regularized equations. And the condition you have to meet is that delta t squared g times h, h being the mean layer depth, and alpha is really the dimension of length, and what is typically used in the UK Met Office is that this is sort of 3 to 4 times the mesh size, the horizontal mesh size. So you, in each time step, you have to sort of invert this Helmholtz problem. That gives you the regularized And then otherwise, you do the time stepping as described here. This staggered. And then you have to combine it because you have the advection terms. You also have to worry about how to avoid stability constraints. So in the advection, you do the same Lagrangian. So it's then linearly, it's unconditionally stable time stepping. Of course, you mistreat all waves that live on a wavelength shorter than alpha. But that's OK, because you're not going to resolve these waves very well on the grid anyway. Right. So let me just, something that occurred to me while listening to Ernst's talk this morning. So let's briefly look at the even simpler equation, the wave equation. And maybe add the nonlinear term here. So what we would now sort of do as a time stepping method is the leapfrog. And we would even simplify this a bit further by simplifying this side, because we say this is sort of a small term anyway. So you would say, okay, well, it's actually just so this is level n, right? So this is all level n. No, I actually wanted to make it simpler than that. So you basically, what this step does here on the level of the linear equation, it modifies the dispersion relation, right? So because you basically, you replace the second spatial derivative by this divided by this. So just, I mean, roughly speaking, it's vector space divided, right? So I think all the machinery that Ernst developed this morning for us is sort of should be applicable to show that this will also conserve all the adiabatic invariants, hopefully very well, provided now you still have to deal, of course, with you get modified frequencies. So you basically have provided some sort of resonance, non-resonance conditions. And the dispersion relation actually, if you just have, I mean, Ernst had a sigma here as well, so we're not having this for the moment. So basically, the dispersion relation for the exact wave equation goes like this. Now, for our numerical, the modified is something like 1 over alpha, I believe, or so, is sort of a truncation. So it levels off, essentially. So the high modes are actually eventually getting in complete resonance. Well, that's OK, I guess. They could then talk to each other. But they have very small amplitude anyway if you have enough solution regularity. So I think that would be something interesting to see if one can show for the linear wave equation, really analyze the behavior of this regularization in a rigorous way. It's basically actually, it's talking about analysis of the implicit midpoint method, right? Because you more or less have an equivalence, except that you treat this explicitly, right? You don't treat implicit midpoint, but treat this implicit, but you make this explicit. Right, so the last few minutes, I want to talk about a final issue. I suggest I want to leave. So essentially, in at least in the application typically in the application setting, this difference is actually not small. I mean, it's not sort of 10 to the minus 8 or something, at least certainly not in metrology. So this is actually some sort of sizable difference that's maybe it's small, but it's not sort of completely negligible. So what you really would like to do is to say, okay, well, there's actually something I'm missing here. And it's exactly this this sort of mapped away difference, which I'm not resolving by the implicit midpoint method, right? So I can't simply take this because it's... I have to get this somewhere from somewhere else in a way. So this residual term here. And so we've been trying to toy around with models that give you some intuition what this R could be, and that has led us to consider weak wave models. That's work with Colin Cotter. Actually, it's most of it is in his thesis, 3 or 4. Probably not going to get completely through it, but let me give you the idea. So now the oscillations come back in again, but we're going to simplify the occurrence of these oscillations and try to analyze them. So we introduce the layer depth perturbation, h being a constant, the mean layer depth, and h is the current layer depth. Then we introduce the divergence, call it b, and then there's a very important quantity, potential vorticity, which is curl of u plus Coriolis term divided by layer depth. And then you rewrite, using these variables, you write the shallow water equations as they're up there. It turns out that this is exactly material advected. It has to do with the underlying symmetry of the equations. So this is a materially advected quantity, PV. It's therefore quite a bit of interest to metrology. Then we get an equation. So this you get basically by taking the curl of the momentum equation. Now we take the divergence of the momentum equation, you get the divergence equation. And then the continuity equation is essentially rewritten using... So now, nothing has changed so far. So now you can read off a popular slow dynamics model. So this is now we really derive an equation on the slow manifold, which is in this case is a particular scaling limit behind is QJ quasi-geostrophic approximation. And the quasi-geostrophic approximation is basically saying this equation I'm not going to change because it's absolutely fundamental to the physics, but I ignore the left-hand sides. So I get B equal to 0. I get... geostrophic balance, which those of you who were at my talk last week already got exposed to. And then we introduce, actually, we're slightly changing this here. We keep the basic structure, but we change this variable to capital Q, which is linearized PV. And... it's this, and that's approximately. So it's basically a scaled and shifted variant of the PV, of the true PV, but then we also linearize using the fact that H over the layer depth variation over the mean layer depth is very small, which makes sense, at least locally. And so, so then we also get the equation essentially dq dt equal to zero. Okay, so this is a model for the slow dynamics. So now to get the waves back in, we, as I said, we looked at this. We derived this weak wave model. And what you do is, the first step is you you essentially do a very simple trick. You take this and replace this quantity by q plus this expression. And then you keep this equation, just make it a capital Q. And in this equation here, you drop all the nonlinearities. So from the last equation, of course, if you drop all the nonlinearities, this will go out, and this product will go out. So you're just left with this equation. Here you drop essentially the advection term. And as I said, you eliminate this expression using the above formulation of PV. So you get minus G and in the velocity field, you make use that eta is essentially a stream function for the velocity field. So you replace U by geostrophic balance is actually determined by eta. And so you can write this equation then as minus G over F. And so you're left with, this is the standard Jacobian operator, fx gy minus fy gx. Right, so you have made use of the geostrophic approximation, which I had up there, right? So the second line, I mean, b equal to naught, the second equation there. So what this is doing now, you basically have the slow dynamics and linear wave dynamics over the manifold. So you basically, you have a slow manifold, and you have now oscillations back in, but they're linear. So you have basically linearized the oscillations. And to finish this, we basically have done two things with this model. The first is, what happens if you essentially start on the slow manifold? Can you use sort of these results of Bambusi, actually, in a 1D version then, to show that it will take very long time to drift away? That's sort of the question, how easily gravity waves are generated by the mean flow. So gravity wave generation. And the second is rough initial data, when you say you initialize eta and b by according to a given probability conditioned on the slow dynamics. And that leads to sort of the cuts, Moritz-Wanzig. Reduction and reduced sort of stochastic SDEs, which basically, to finish this, give at least an intuition, I mean, not a rigorous, but an intuition what this should be. And it should have fluctuations and dissipation terms basically coming out of this analysis here. Okay, thank you very much.
Now we know whom to blame for the weather. Yes. Any questions?
Well, there's not much blame today, I guess, so I take it easily.
To claim credit for
yes,
the weather.
I take credit for the weather for today.
Any questions?
Sebastian, you correct me if I'm wrong, but I think sort of the major term that you are trying to control is essentially, as you said, divergence of your time derivative of displacements.
Right.
And, you know, exactly this term contains the most difficulties because this is essentially spatio-temporal sort of multi-scale character of the process itself.
But this is the idea of this sort of adaptive slow manifold. Because you're actually only controlling the parts of the changes in divergence which are below your time scale you're integrating, so to speak, right?
But you sort of ignore spatial scale and temporal scale interactions in this case. If you
Well, of course, there's always, I mean, any time scale, there's sort of a spatial scale.
And this is roughly contained in this term.
Yeah, that's exactly in there, but it's everything that's above that spatial scale and which is resolved in your model, you're not constraining. That can freely evolve. And so if you want to do a non-hydrostatic model, so you really want to have, and even if you want to do, let's say you want to do a non-hydrostatic model, so you really want to have some of much more of the compressibility, all the cavity waves being built in, and part of the acoustic modes as well, the very long-range acoustic modes, they would not be constrained. So it's very different from filtered equations where you really write down divergence equal to zero or some elastic approximations or so, where then all the modes are constrained. So this is really adaptively adjusting to the step size and the length scale of your model. And everything that's below your grid resolution, you can't do anything, right? Anyway, so that's just doing the right thing in a way. And if you need to include anything that's below your grid resolution, well, then the best thing you can still do is to say parameterization in terms of fluctuation dissipations in some sense. Or you have to go to proper multiscale methods and super parameterizations also where you locally try to capture what's going on.
Would it be fair to say that automatically you sort of restrict your sort of boundary regions where you could do this resolution, which in a sense sort of a problem, if you like, controlling wave equation using boundary control in some way? By building sort of set of normalization procedures that we are trying to do. And of course, there is a vast literature in that field.
Yeah. I'm not quite sure if I immediately see this, but maybe we can talk afterwards about this. I mean,
Any further questions? Okay, so we'll reconvene in 2 hours. Let us thank Sebastian and all the speakers this morning.